I'm just looking at a story here. You know, these men are in. I mean, these are pioneers of the unknown country. You would think, as fragile as the human head is, I admonished many a young person about the use of helmets. And I used a very simple example. It is, okay, come hands and knees now, right now, with me on the, get on your hands and knees on the sidewalk here. And this won't take long. Now, I want you to very gently bump your head on the sidewalk. You feel that? Yeah, now what do you think is going to happen if you come off your motorcycle or your bicycle or your skates with no helmet on? That's right. Now, if that's not bad enough, I'm looking at an article here about Finley Boyle, a three-year-old Hawaiian girl who suffered massive brain injuries last month after a dental procedure and who passed away as a result of it. Now, the first thing that gets my attention in this article is that there were root canals, cavities to be filled, and root canals on a three-year-old. Yeah. All right. I don't want to digress too much, and I certainly don't want to insert any opinions here, but I have a few, and I'm sure you do too. We'll be right back with the good doctors when we return. This is Coast to Coast AM. Just don't go anywhere. Gentlemen, as we go through this, now we, as first-time guests, certainly you're not used to me, and I'll just come out of left field with some crazy question that sometimes just horrifies guests. So I'm going to try and avoid that tonight, but I take it that there are only rudimentary baseline diagnoses protocols in place now, because, well, I wonder several things. Obviously, human beings make mistakes. And we all know that the person that graduates at the very top of their medical class and the very bottom of their medical class, both are called doctor. And we all have our areas of expertise. And again, I repeat, people make mistakes. But what sorts of ethical problems do you run into in situations like these where, I mean, do people give up too early on very many patients? They just go non-responsive. We're pulling the plug. I mean, is there an exhaustive protocol of some sort in place now, let alone calling in, I would say the big guns. I would say you men are the big guns. And I'm just wondering how does this happen? Because you hear repeatedly, injured in car accident, injured in this, came off a stool, whatever, non-responsive. That's it. We're done. Are they in a?
John really go into this, Dr. Fellows, because he is the maverick treating. I'm involved in helping to develop the science and put together theories into practice, and when those theories are essentially proven through scientific methods, then we have to then translate that into a treatment. And when you do something new, guess what?
Yeah.
That is not accepted, because what you learned in school, in medical school, was something totally different. And in these cases, it's a wait-and-see policy. It's not an active treatment protocol. So, John, if you want to, you know, go with that, because you are one of the treatment pioneers who's really taken the science and translated it into an integrated treatment.
Right. So, John, you said that, is there comprehensive? You would think there would be, but in fact, you're right. It's very fragmented right now. There are biases on both sides. Doctors who most consider at the top of the heap, in society, tend to look down at a poor quality of life and say, well, I certainly wouldn't want that, so I'm not going to recommend that for my patients. And there's still a lot of holdover from this very paternalistic way where doctors and other clinicians, except for a handful of pockets of a few here and there, really their bias is, well, number one, I don't want to waste resources. Number two, I don't want to waste my time. Number three, I don't want to come to work today for tiny possible gains or mostly no gains at all, and why should I bother showing up if I'm going to be, you know, taking care of a bunch of potted plants? And, you know, many of our patients, Dr. DeFina has really kept a list of this, that, you know, we're told early on, you're brain dead, that's it. And what doctors say and what patients hear and the terminology that Dr. DeFina referred to is all mixed up. And so, yeah, you're right. Very often, early on, families are told that the brain is essentially dead, or the brain is mostly dead, or this person isn't going to have a quality of life. The unspoken word there is that I would want to have.
Right.
So that leads to a very fragmented, a very kind of rush to justice with a lot of biases on both sides. And so our approach is to very much take a much more comprehensive and nuanced approach and to leave no stone unturned. You know, John, what the families want at the end of the day, in a family like Jahi McMath's family, and I spoke to the mother, and she echoed what I've heard for, you know, almost two decades now from my patients, is they want to know at the end of the day, when they put their head on the pillow, that they've done everything for their loved one that is reasonably available and possible. And, of course, one hurdle for that is that the medical system is not set, not only is it not set up to put those resources up front, it tends to be put on the back end, where, you know, someone will just, if it's a family that really yells and screams and it's the squeaky wheel, well, then, you know, like you have a Terry Schiavo or someone, and you have them, you know, linger and languish in a back ward, and then they get no treatment. And the second half of that is, of course, you know, the big, what are the 64 million pound gorilla in the room is the issue of organ donation. So a combination of those two factors leads to this rush to justice, very fragmented approach that is decidedly and distinctly different from our approach. You know, John, what I like to say over the years is as long as we're looking for needles in haystacks, it pays to know which haystacks have needles.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good one. That's quite a good one.
That. Yeah.
That should go into brainy quotes.
Yeah, I had to conceptualize this idea over the years where what we were doing with the International Brain Research Foundation and the translational research is we are trying to front load this process. We are trying to develop an algorithm, a treatment, what some people call a care path in medicine, where if this happens, you know, if stroke happens, then there's a 3-day protocol in most hospitals now. Whereas, you know, go back 10, 15, 20 years, it might have taken a few weeks to do this. Well, now it happens in 3 days. Boom, boom, boom. Very, very, you know, very efficient and coordinated way. Why? Because, of course, insurance companies are pushing hospitals to do this and get everyone out. Well, you know, not every condition can be decided upon. You know, the dust doesn't settle in 3 days on every single neurological condition. It takes time, effort, it takes testing, it's a moving target. It takes treatment. You know, the biggest problem with brain death, and we can come back to this, and I'll try to just give you this one. You'll put a marker here and come back to this. The problem with the term brain death is that in the definition of brain death is the word irreversible. Well, that's a setup, isn't it?
That seems like it, yeah.
We'll come back to that one. So let me just try and finish the thought on our approach. And how fragmented, you know, the rest of the world is in our approach to this. You know, we're trying to develop this algorithm where with each patient that we treat, we get a better idea through the neuromarkers that DeFina and others brought to this table, this have accumulated from around the world in the team. The neuromarkers is the testing. Then we address those. We address them anatomically. We provide the building blocks for the brain to repair itself. And then we chemically assess things, and we try to use medications to rebalance the chemical environment in the brain. Metabolically, I mentioned, you got to put high-test fuel in the tank. Electrically, you mentioned before the break, magnetically. There are magnetic techniques, both observing the brain magnetically with something called a MEG machine, very rare machine, which we've worked with, and then treatment-wise, therapeutically, with magnetic stimulation, which Dr. DeFina really has brought into this treatment matrix, this model. So it's bringing all of these tools to bear simultaneously that gives the brain the best possible chance. You know, getting back to the term irreversible for a moment, you know, there's a term called therapeutic nihilism or nihilism, which is a very complex term, but I'll break it. It's very simple. It goes like this. If you think nothing will help, and now we're back to those doctors and clinicians who think, well, I've never seen anything help, therefore I'm not going to recommend anything, and lo and behold, nothing happens. And that doctor gets to be a prophet with a 100% track record.
Sure.
He's 100% right, because he said, nothing's going to work, therefore I'm not going to suggest anything, and nothing will happen. And look, I was right. See, nothing happened. That's crazy.
Jonathan, I wanted to expand on that for John as well, because I heard this saying, and I forget at this point where I heard it, but that death is a rough marker for a complex biological event. So if we think about this, and the fact that we're looking at this rough marker called death, and we're focusing on brain death, not brain life, brain death. So essentially, most of the details in the neurologic exam that physicians are trained in are to try to look at what the patients lack,
what
they lack in responsiveness. It's all absence, signs of absence, absence of brainstem reflexes,
absence
of ocular movements, absence of a corneal reflex, et cetera, et cetera. So what they're looking at and trying to focus on is the death of the brain.
Yes, what's not happening, not what is happening.
And we're trying to focus on what's preserved and what can be reorganized in order to bring the life back in what we consider oftentimes is a dormant and not a dead brain, a brain that is trying to regulate itself in this complex environment. And due to the extreme damage, it's shutting down systems in order to maintain a level of functionality to maintain life.
Protect.
We're trying to figure out, how do you reboot that system? How do you expand upon that capability to improve these functions?
You mentioned the MEG machine. Is that, I'm guessing that's magnetic encephalogram, maybe?
Very good.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, I don't want to pull us too far afield here, but I think this all comes back from the tinfoil hat thing. How does magnetism affect the brain? In other words, when you apply various magnetic fields, does it, I take it, it not only reveals something, but it also causes something. And then my brain started wandering a little bit, and I thought, I wonder about cell phones. It's electromagnetic radiation. I mean, that's magnetic. I wonder what kind of radiation they're using in their MEG machine. And I just started thinking about that. And so just take it anywhere you want to go, including forget it and move on to something else.
No, it's very important. Electromagnetism is one of the four major forces in the universe, in nature, and it's everywhere. The consciousness can be understood as an electromagnetic phenomenon. So basically, theorists have started to relate consciousness to electromagnetism. And I come from that school. And when I was at the Brain Research Laboratories at NYU, I worked with a very bright guy, who's now deceased, named E. Roy John, who was one of the theorists and helped me to develop my thinking with regard to the realm of consciousness and how brains produce electromagnetic fields. So these electromagnetic field theories go into what we call quantum mind theories. I don't want to go off on a tangent. It's very complex mathematics and physics. It's like that old Elton John song, that line that says, all the science I don't understand, it's just my job 5 days a week, I'm a rocket man. Well, essentially, this is what we're doing. We're learning, and we're trying to understand the complexities of neuroscience with the unique opportunity of having a window to observe it with these instruments like MEG, to be able to look at electromagnetic activity. And the MEG machine, which you would correctly mentioning, John, doesn't actually give off the electromagnetic force. It actually measures the brain's electromagnetic activity that's being generated, and it collects this very complex data to be able to ascertain the electromagnetic fields and to understand those functions in relation to normal brain functioning and abnormal brain functioning. You can look at things like schizophrenia, autism, depression, brain injury, coma, in relation to these electromagnetic changes that are being picked up by this machine and then are analyzed in a way to be able to understand the lesion, so to speak, from this electromagnetic perspective. Once we do that, we can then take electrical and magnetic stimulation devices, like a transcranial direct current stimulator or a transcranial magnetic stimulator, and we can change the electromagnetic activity to move back into what we call a normal range in order to recover function. So the capability of using advanced technologies like MEG and specialized EEGs to understand electrical and magnetic activity in the brain then allows us to use different stimulation devices to change electrical and magnetic activity in the proper direction and to reorganize that activity for normal function, or as close as we can get.
This is extraordinary.
Yeah, each brain injury is different, too, so it has its own, you know, unique fingerprint, if you will. I don't know, brain print, you might say. And so even though you have these chunks of categories, coma, vegetative state, mentally conscious, no two look the same within a given category. No two coma patients look the same if you measure their brain in enough different ways. You get these differences. So we're not about treating the disease, the disorder, so much as we are about treating the individual and their unique brain print, if I can continue with that coined word, their unique imbalances. And that's another thing I've learned from Dr. DeFino over the years is, you know, coming from a neurologic background, neurology background, I figured, you know, Parkinson's is Parkinson's. And I knew that each Parkinson's patient, but I hadn't really thought of it as being so different from one individual to the next, and therefore that individual requiring a unique chemical and electrical and magnetic and metabolic soup to really satisfy their needs.
This is amazing. And Dr. DeFina, did you just say consciousness is an electromagnetic phenomenon, or was that you, Dr. Fellas?
That was me.
An electromagnetic phenomenon, and each brain has its own signature?
Correct. And we're looking to understand electromagnetism or electromagnetic forces within the brain to understand what is a normal range in a human to give us these different kinds of functions. But the unique characteristics are very individual. The fingerprint of that particular person or the electromagnetic print of that particular person, the unique capabilities of the individual's electrical and magnetic system needs to be looked at in relation to the capabilities that they either have or lost. And how do we look at an electroweak force versus, you know, an electromagnetic force that's within normal ranges, and then understand how we can then resolve that by changing that electromagnetic activity into the realm of normal function.
This is amazing. Have I got some questions for you coming up on the other side of this break? Well, they're interesting to me. We'll find out if they're interesting to you. Doctors Jonathan Fellas and Philip A. DeFina. And the most interesting and controversial discussion revolving around the controversial case of 13-year-old Jahi McMath. We shall return. This is Coast to Coast AM. Pleasure to be in with you tonight after skipping last weekend. Played a little bit of hooky, Little reset. Believe it or not, yes, you heard it on Coast to Coast AM. That's Donna Summer. I feel love. And I'll tell you the truth, I do feel love. I feel love for humanity coming from Doctors Jonathan Fellas and Philippe DeFina. That's what drives it all, isn't it? And I'll tell you, there are many things that have grabbed me rather tightly. Some of the things that they've said tonight. Among them, consciousness is an electromagnetic phenomenon. Every brain has its own magnetic signature. I'm going to see if I can pull the good doctors on a little bit of a side trip. I'm wondering, as I have for many years, what are all these TV and radio stations and cell phones and all these various radios, these transmitters of electromagnetic radiation? I wonder what they're actually doing to us. And if each brain has its own, shall we just call it, its own magnetic code, if it can be manipulated to bring a person back into a state of health, can the converse be possible as well? We'll find out if they even want to discuss this when we come back. This is the one, the only, Coast to Coast AM. Gentlemen, I hope you're not getting bored at this late hour of the night, but I got to tell you that the people who are sending emails in here, they're not bored, and I'm certainly not, so let's just carry on. We've got a good bit of time left together. How about that? Now, this may not be your thing at all, but I know you think about these things. This can be sort of an off-the-record kind of thing, just speculation and opinion. What do you imagine, or have you ever thought much about the effects on human health that all this electromagnetic radiation just being beamed out all over the place is having on the human being and the human condition?
Well, John, magnetic stimulation from the environment, which is not controlled, those fields can cause disruption of cells in the body. And can create difficulties which result in diseases. So electromagnetic fields that come from sources that are very intense in the environment or prolonged effects can cause deleterious effects of various cells in the body, can cause cancers, dysfunction, etc. We're looking at things of that nature and other aspects of things that we're doing, and we probably do a whole other show on some of those things. But when we use transcranial magnetic stimulation, that's a very controlled, very, very tiny amount that actually can change things in a positive way.
Very targeted.
But yet we are exposed to, high tension wires and various other electrical fields that are being generated by a lot of the high tech kinds of things that we're accustomed to using now, including phones.
Yeah, I was reading an article that I found it quite interesting. That we don't ever gain anything without we don't ever get anything good without sort of trading it for something bad. And, I've just been wondering over the years, these 100,000-watt television transmitters, and people live right over there. You don't really see what the effects are, but we do know that we're experiencing rates of disease that are almost unprecedented. And now, of course, this leads into something else, which is I don't think they're going to shut them off. That's number one. I don't think people are going to give up their cell phones, although, particularly Nokia out of Finland, I think they were possibly the first to include in their instruction manual. Now listen, don't be putting this thing right up next to your head. Keep an inch between your body and the phone. Of course, you can't do that if you've got the thing to your ear, but it's like we're telling you this could be detrimental to your health. And yeah, I didn't mean to suggest that what you're doing with the application of magnetism was going to be detrimental to the patient. I was just, you answered my question. It's not good for you.
Right. Those things should be studied, and they should continue to be studied. But we're more interested in the healing aspect, and we can't squander our attention and resources in that direction.
Well, yeah. There's only one life for every person. You can devote your entire life to that. And really, I'm on your side in this. I think we'd probably be better off going for the healing aspect of things. Let me ask you this. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. One thing I was going to say is that we do have some studies that are related, which we can probably talk about at another point in time, where the electrical activity in the brain obviously impacts and controls the electrical activity in our heart, two organs that function in our body with electrical and magnetic fields. So we actually are the first to have published with our colleagues in Germany, led by Dr. Max Hiltz, the first studies where sudden death syndrome, we have healthy individuals who are in the gym every day and watching their diet and essentially, you know, doing all the right things, all of a sudden the person drops out of a heart attack. And I said, oh my God, what the heck happened to this guy? He was a health fanatic. He was in the gym. He was watching his diet and he died. Well, traumatic brain injuries can affect the regulation of the brain stem. The brain stem is what controls consciousness. And the signals from that brain stem go to the heart. And essentially, if there's some dysregulation of that electrical activity from the brainstem to the heart, it can short-circuit the heart and result in a heart attack or life-threatening change in blood pressure or other cardiovascular event, which results in sudden death syndrome. So we found that these heart attacks, which people said, hey, there's something wrong with the heart, actually is really something wrong with the electrical system that starts in the brain and results in short-circuiting the heart. So there's a lot that we're starting to learn about electrical activity in the body and how the brain interfaces with the heart. And like Dr. Fellows was saying before, this particular patient in California, this girl, had a cardiovascular event which resulted in lack of oxygen to the brain and put her into this dire state of prolonged, you know, disordered consciousness, which they're claiming may be brain death. We don't know at this point, but certainly much more has to be done in order to make that determination, we believe.
Have any of your studies led you into anywhere near Alzheimer's? That seems like that's a different kind of brain damage, I suppose.
I have a whole initiative for Alzheimer's and disorders of the aging brain, as well as disorders of the developing brain, like autism spectrum, attention deficit. So we're looking at multiple areas and looking at research in those areas. However, our foundation, because it's small and relatively new, doesn't have the funding to really, you know, devote the amount of time and energy into these important areas that you're talking about. And that's what we want to do that. And we're very excited about doing it and expanding this approach to Alzheimer's, to autism. We started doing it. We're seeing some success, but we need more resources to expand in those directions.
Understood. You mentioned, use the analogy of a high-performance automobile and giving it proper fuels and so forth. And, of course, this is, you know, I'm not trying to turn this into a vitamin infomercial here or anything. Is there good fuel for a brain that can fortify it in any way? I mean, are we talking your basic omega-3s, and there are several products that claim to improve memory and these things? I mean, have you found that there are certain nutritional components that are effective in maintaining brain health, and maybe even to the point where it can more easily sustain, you know, an externally applied injury, anything like that? That, you know, like
our protocol, John, actually uses there are three components to it. There's electrical and magnetic stimulation. There's medications, traditional medications that are more focused and targeted from the neuromarkers, as Dr. Fellows was talking about, and there are combinations of nutraceuticals, antioxidants, anti-inflammatory agents, Dr. Larry Sears, who works with us, is one of the top experts on using omega-3. And we do incorporate that as an anti-inflammatory agent because we believe that many of these disease entities and trauma and changes in consciousness also are due to brain inflammation. So the use of the omega-3s and the use of very targeted nutraceuticals to for anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, and neuroprotective capabilities for the brain and general brain health are really important. We actually are criticized for that because we're using natural products that enhance brain functions as opposed to just traditional medications. But we understand the side effects of traditional medications and the fact that these products oftentimes do a better job in specific areas like antioxidant, anti-inflammatory areas. And then Dr. Fellows combines them. He combines the traditional medications with the nutraceuticals, which is a rare thing that a physician does. Jonathan, why don't you get into that a little bit?
Well, you know, let's make it more concrete and bring it back to the controversy of brain death. Dr. Defina and I and our team that we've assembled are currently treating a VIP overseas, not unlike Jahai, who suffered a lack of oxygen, lack of blood from a cardiac and respiratory arrest. And we're treating this young woman with a combination of, Phil, about 30 different nutraceuticals, I think we're up to.
We have nutraceuticals, probably. Yeah, we're in the range of 30 nutraceuticals. And the dosing and the synergy of using the various nutraceuticals with one another in the specific combinations and specific dosing is what really is the important component of this.
And, you know, that just brings me back to another point I wanted to mention before, that, you know, the criticism from people, well, you're using all these things, you don't even know, you haven't tested them individually. John, there's been 50, 60, 70 different treatments that have failed to show any benefit in brain injury. How many more failures do we need before someone has the bright idea of putting two or three or five or 10 things together that we have a basic understanding that the brain needs? I mean, the Wright brothers didn't start off with just a left wing and crash off Kitty Hawk and say, well, gee, left wing doesn't work. Let's try just a propeller. They have a basic idea. You need two wings and a propeller and something in the middle to sit in and maybe an engine to power it. So, you know, it's crazy to think that we're just going to test one thing after another after another. The conventional wisdom, sadly, the orthodoxy of the scientific method is, let's just manipulate one variable at a time. Well, guess what? We're never going to get there in our lifetime. And families are not going to wait around for nothing to happen, you know, decade after decade. So these other places in the world are just, you say, well, what are they doing? The answer is they're testing, and they're testing. And they're testing sometimes to death, literally.
Yeah.
They're just studying the problem over and over and over, trying to move the ball down the field 1 millimeter at a time, because that's the grant money they get through these grant and funding sources. It's a glacial pace because that's the way the system is set up. And where there's no more, there's a great book out recently, a couple of years ago, called Free Radicals. And one of its theories, ideas that it highlights is that we've lost great science. We've lost the creativity, the energy, the bold ideas. And that's what excited me about joining the International Brain Research Foundation and Dr. Fina's group all those years ago, is that I wanted to do great science that had a potential for major impact. And So that's what the rest of the world is doing. They're failing one step at a time, and they're taking a bottom-up approach. We're taking a top-down approach. We're taking a results approach. We get the results first, then we'll figure out exactly why each thing helped or didn't at some later point down the road. That's about building the algorithm. You get results, and then you figure out why you need different components in any different, you know, given in a single individual.
Well, you know, I have to commend you on this. I mean, this is a beautiful thing. Nobody decided, I think I'll build a fluorescent tube. It's like, no, what you do first is you observe that, wow, when we apply power to this powder, it kind of like glows. I wonder what would happen if we put it in a vacuum tube. Let's try that. So it's like you get the effect first, and then you come up with the invention to apply the effect to. I mean, I think I'm close here.
Exactly. And John, the conventional wisdom with the lack of treatment and the use of one or two medications, which Dr. Fellows has talked about, the failure of these one and two medications, results in a less than 10% recovery rate. And we published an article in Restorative Neurology and Neuroscience in 2010, which was a real pioneering article on improving outcomes of severe disorders of consciousness, and with 41 patients who were deemed unrecoverable, we had a 78% to 86% recovery rate, which is, you know, 15 times greater than the national average. And, you know, this is, you know, this is objective data that we looked at in a retrospective analysis of these patients that we treated. And now we're replicating that in a prospective study that's currently going on, which is supported by the Department of Defense, because in that group were military personnel who had severe brain injuries and coma and prolonged vegetative state, who were getting nowhere with multi-million dollar resources from the government really not being able to do anything positive for them. And we were able to make some major changes in their lives. And as a result, now we're doing a second study, which is being sponsored by the Department of Defense, because of the improvements that we had. But the capability of combining these methods in this algorithm that we've developed has proven extremely successful. And believe it or not, that's very disturbing to the status quo.
There's a lot of resistance when you shake up the status quo. That's right.
Oh, always. But you know what I love about you two fellas? You're annoying the establishment. And I love that. I love systems busters. I love it. I really mean it. You know, one of the most valuable things that I ever heard, he's an old man now. His last name's Roberts. And he used to work for Phillips Petroleum and other things. They made things. Anyway, I asked him one time, I said, Mr. Roberts, I need some new ideas. How do you come up with a new idea? And he said, he's an old man now. He said, just put two or three things together and you got a new idea.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, I'm going to hold on to that for the rest of my life. And it's true. These people seem to be, the vast majority of people just, I don't know what makes human beings just stick. Mm-hmm. Say, what's the magnetic signature of people who are willing to bust the system and go look at something else? Mm-hmm. Instead of fixating on the symptom, they go, wait. What caused this? We know that it's broken. We're all looking at it. We all agree. But what caused it? Why is that such a rare thing? People have been complaining about it, finally, openly, for, oh, well, I've talked and talked, and now I hear the music. But anyway, what's the difference between somebody? Have you been able to figure out what's the difference between somebody who's willing to buck the system and the ones that just go along with it?
Well, we're definitely bucking the system, that's for sure.
Almost everything that's considered medically spectacular today was once considered impossible. You know, keeping a 26-year-old preemie alive, infant. So, someone had to put two or three things together to overcome that hurdle. And
yeah.
you can be sure that insurance wasn't paying for it then, and they weren't really, you know, being cheered on by their compatriots. You can believe that.
While we take this break, that'll give you a few moments to go, oh gosh, is he really going to ask that question? So I'll give it to you in advance. As there seems to be this push towards socialized medicine, what does that do to improve the odds of some people who could be brought back? Are they just going to be let go? Are their organs more valuable? Got a couple of million bucks worth of guts in there. How much more valuable is that than the productivity of this person who is now unresponsive? We'll be back. This is Coast to Coast AM.